Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell discusses the reasons behind the rising cost of groceries and how he says targeted tariffs can make a difference. Jay Fox will also speak with experts on human trafficking and medical legislation. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Columbus is experiencing a 3.1% increase in grocery prices this year. Coffee's up 41%, iceberg lettuce 21%, orange juice 12%. And there are too many other products to mention, but I'm betting you know what they are. Central Ohioans want to know what is causing this increase, and the answer may be tariffs on tinplate steel. Former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about these tariffs and their impact on our wallet. Welcome, sir. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Good morning. It's always good to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning, Ken. What is tinplate steel and how does it relate to food?
The cost of tinplate steel, as well as the cost of fertilizer, all affect the pricing of groceries. And as a consequence, if in fact you have tariffs, you have an ineffective policy like overtaxing tinplate steel. And so one of the things that the president is starting to do now that he's effectively used the sledgehammer is to start to narrow cast his concern about pricing on groceries and gas and what have you with his use of tariffs. Look, tariffs are basically used to crack down on foreign cheaters and to protect our manufacturing base. And that's what the president has done with his accelerated approach to growth. So, look, he has, in fact, brought down the price of gas through reassuming our approach to energy dominance. Do we still have work to do? We sure do. And I think that's why we're now starting to focus on a more surgical approach to the impact of tariffs on the cost of tinplate steel. If my Campbell's soup comes in tinplate steel, so as a consequence, when the price of the Campbell goes up on steel, it affects the price of my soup. And so as they bring it to me at the grocery store. So look, the president has put us back on a rapid, trajectory of economic growth, and it's going to be important that he brings his approach to tariffs on some goods like groceries and tinplate steel in the focus. And I think he's doing that. I mean, this is a guy who basically understands that capital seeks the path of least resistance and greatest opportunity, and the way that you expand our base and attract new capital is to, in fact, make our economic environment conducive to economic growth.
Okay, so take me to school on something. What's the difference between a standard tariff and a targeted tariff?
You live in a standard tariff when you're going after a bad actor like China that cheats and dumps steel. You have that broad approach. Sometimes that broad approach takes a hit on something that where you actually need price to come down. And so the president is looking at the impact of his standard approach on a targeted on a target like tinplate steel. And I think he will adjust. He will adjust his tariff regime.
So you think that this targeted tariff will bring the prices of your soup down? Okay, well, that's what's important.
Yeah. You know, and all of those who go to the grocery stores and look for the best deals will appreciate what the impact of the president's approach. And again, I don't try to separate not only the impact of template steel on the price of groceries, but the impact on the cost of fertilizer to grow the vegetables. And that's why the more targeted approach with tariffs and his re-embrace of energy dominance work hand in hand in bringing the affordability of goods in America back within the reach of working families.
Now, you and I have been in Ohio a long time, and I'm sure you've read recent reports, say Republic Steel is talking with foreign steelmakers about bringing steel manufacturing back to Ohio. How will this help with this particular problem?
Well, again, you know, we need to crack down on bad actors like China who go around dumping steel, and so the president's approach is to make sure that we, in fact, increase the manufacturing of steel and therefore increase jobs. And when you increase jobs, you increase incomes to American families. And I think that you look at the president's team that's talking with American-based steel companies, you see that as their overall overarching strategy to make things affordable for working families and to increase the income of working families. And people can go back and look that before, you know, COVID and that travesty, the president had us on a path of economic expansion, growth, job creation, and lifting of incomes that were almost unsurpassed by any other American president.
So Ohio was built on the backbone of steel. And if all of this good news happens and steel comes back to the Buckeye State, I'll bet you 10 cents off your Campbell soup can.
You got it. You know, look, I keep my shoulder to the wheel and my eyes focused on the cost of soup and other basic foods in my grocery cart.
Well, I suppose it depends on where you shop.
But you know, I'm a Cincinnati boy, and Kroger is my place.
Well, you know, and we have Kroger here in Columbus, but of course, you know, if you go to Cincinnati, you got to go to Jungle Jim's just once.
That's right, you sure do.
All right,
we have a variety.
Secretary, where can we go to learn more about this subject?
Well, you can go to KimBlackwell.com, or you can really take a hard look at our economic portfolio at the America First Policy Institute.
Okay. Former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, thank you for your time this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Human trafficking is not a new issue. It dates back to the foundations of civilization. However, it is top of mind now, especially here in central Ohio, as the I-70 corridor continues to be a hot route for transportation. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost reports that in 2025, there were 135 arrests in a major operation and 875 hotline tips leading to 125 credible cases sent to law enforcement. Erica Reed, the acting section chief with the Blue Campaign at the Center for Countering Human Trafficking, joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the realities of what human trafficking looks like in our community, the importance of awareness days like Wear Blue Day, and how we can be more knowledgeable in identifying and reporting suspicious activity. Good morning, and thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
What constitutes human trafficking?
So
Human trafficking is a crime, of course, and it's a crime about exploitation, meaning using a person, and usually done by either forcing them, frauding, and or coercing them into doing something. A lot of times it's misinterpreted, at least the definition, and so people often assume it looks like kidnapping, when in actuality it could look like control, maybe control of their ID, their phone, even money. Maybe someone is on a job and they're not allowed to take breaks. There's a change in behavior, or even we forget about our younger people, our youth. Maybe they're getting these unexplained gifts or expensive gifts from maybe a new person that they just met.
That is very comprehensive, but also very shocking, because most of our audience probably didn't realize half of that constituted human trafficking. So the numbers from the AG's office were shocking. How can this be happening in our own community without us realizing it?
One way is that we have to understand traffickers will use violence, manipulation. They also will have a grooming process, maybe a gradual grooming process, and they will target those that are probably vulnerable in our communities. And some of those vulnerabilities could possibly be like maybe someone who has an economic hardship or a language barrier, or even in some cases, it could be just children. So they do and will kind of target those that are most vulnerable in our communities.
In January, there was a National Awareness Day as part of a month-long public service campaign. Why is it so important to have awareness days like Wear Blue Day, and what impact can those days have on preventing human trafficking?
Yes, on January 11th, persons would, you know, wear the color blue, take a picture, post it on their social media, and then type in the words hashtag Wear Blue Day. We always say that awareness leads to action. From that, it could spark a conversation maybe with the younger person in your life. It also can allow maybe your aunts, uncles to learn more about what human trafficking is. And then there's that solidarity of knowing that there are people out there that want to raise awareness about this. So there could be someone who wants to report, or it's happening to them, and so it's an opportunity to report the particular crime or learn more about it and learn how to report what human trafficking is. So it's a very great way to take action on this particular crime.
When it comes to the overarching concept of human trafficking, which we have covered, to what degree does sexual exploitation come into play, such as forced prostitution?
So we have to remember, once again, going back to the definition, human trafficking is a crime of exploitation. I didn't get a chance to give the full definition, and it's usually a crime of exploitation, meaning, of course, using someone, and they're either doing it through forced labor or either sex trafficking, and it deals with the force, fraud, and or coercion, so meaning forcing someone to do something, frauding them to do something, where that could be more of the psychological manipulation, and of course, we know coercion, where it could be threats, manipulation, or even shame, and all of those can play a role in how someone is trafficking someone, whether it's sex trafficking or forced labor. But I think it's very important to know that anyone under the age of 18, force, fraud, and coercion doesn't have to be involved. If they're engaging in commercial sex act, and the person who's making them engage in it, it is considered human trafficking no matter what.
So what can we do to recognize and report activities and support victims in the community without making mistakes?
First thing first, you can go to our website at bluecampaign.gov. When you get there, make sure you learn about what human trafficking is. Learn the signs and the indicators of human trafficking. And if by chance you come across anything as far as it looks like a potential case of human trafficking, or maybe it's happening to someone as well, you can report it. We have reporting information on each of our pages. And you can contact our tip line to contact law enforcement. You can also contact the National Human Trafficking Hotline as well. And the one great thing about each of those is that they're very easy to report a tip, and it also can be anonymous. If you can't remember bluecampaign.gov, you can always call your local police office at 911 to report it, especially if it's an emergency. One thing that we tell people is to not attempt to go up to someone if you don't know them, especially a trafficker or someone being victimized. And that's for their safety and also the safety of the person being victimized as well.
All right. We want to thank Erica Reed from the Center for Countering Human Trafficking for joining us and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
When insurers force patients to switch medications, deny emergency room coverage after the fact, or require physicians to spend hours appealing arbitrary downcoding, patient care suffers. That's why the Ohio State Medical Association, otherwise known as OSMA, is advocating for major legislative proposals with 9 bills currently advancing in the Ohio General Assembly. CEO Todd Baker joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss what's happening. Good morning and welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Glad to be here.
Todd, let's start at the beginning. What is the Ohio State Medical Association and what role does it play in patient care advocacy?
Sure. We are the state association that represents the profession of physicians across the state. So a lot of people have heard about the American Medical Association. We are the equivalent, but at the state level, for those doctors that are licensed in Ohio. We spend the majority of our time advocating in the legislature, in the legal arena, in the regulatory arena, for physicians and their patients in the issues that they're struggling with on a daily basis to make sure that they're getting the highest quality care they can in Ohio.
Why do insurance companies and pharmacies have the power to dictate medications and override doctors' orders?
Well, Jay, they control the purse strings. So that's the number one thing that impacts their ability to change the process. So they are the ones that will approve whether or not a certain medication is covered by your insurance company or covered. They will be the ones that will determine whether or not a certain procedure that your physician does is covered. So before one of our doctors writes a script, before one of our doctors does a procedure, they are making sure that and seeing whether or not that's covered, whether that's going to get paid, because with the high cost of care, we know that patients need that coverage in order to afford the care that they need.
Was this always the case? Because I'm from a different century, and I don't remember this much consternation back then.
Right. It was. Times have changed, Jay. You are right. I'm from a different era as well, and the era of Marcus Welby coming to your home or you going to see your doctor, you paying your doctor directly, and then if you had insurance coverage, the insurer reimbursing you, the patient, for whatever costs there were. And there weren't nearly as many administrative burdens in the process. Over time, that has changed. What really happened, Jay, was there was an initial focus on saying technology has evolved, drugs have evolved, all these things have evolved. They become more expensive. We have some of these very high ticket items. As insurance companies, let's put a process in place to make sure that those are those really high dollar kinds of things are monitored in a way to make sure that those are actually needed. What has evolved to, Jay, is essentially doing that for everything. So for a Z-Pack that you get when, you know, you have a cold for a thing or a slight infection, for smaller procedures that are, you know, $50 or $25, now everything is subject to the administrative burden. So that's what's happened over time. That's what's created this huge backlog, huge administrative burden. And not only does it affect the physician and the business they run, it ultimately affects the patient and their ability to get care in a timely manner that they know is going to be reimbursed.
So what is the most important piece of legislation that you're fighting for?
So I would say there are three pieces that are really, really important. The piece that's important you mentioned is the medical switching, which is very patient-centric. And we all know when you look at your insurance company every year, this is the time of year when there's open enrollment and you're looking at what kind of coverage you're going to have for the year ahead. You, most of the time these days, you're looking at, is my drug that I'm on for my chronic illness, or are the medications that I routinely take, or my spouse routinely takes, or my child routinely takes, are they on the drug formulary? Are they covered? And we pick our plan a lot of times based upon that. Well, what can happen is in the middle of the year, right now in Ohio, an insurer can change that formulary and you're no longer going to have that covered. So what we're simply asking for in the legislation is, hey, whatever you advertise at the beginning of the year that's on your formulary, I've signed up with you for the year. You make sure that that's covered for the year. And then the other two that are really important is something called prior authorization that patients and doctors deal with all the time. And that is, before I do a procedure, I got to get the blessing of the insurance company. It could take a day, it could take 2 days, could take a week, could take 2 weeks. It slows down the process. And in most cases, it's going to get approved, but it can really hamper how efficiently a physician can provide care and how quickly someone can come in and get it. So it makes the offices run efficient and it makes sure the patient gets the care in a timely manner. And then the other one is pretty specific to our business model, the physician's business model, and that's something called downcoding. And that's when I bill for something at a think about it in various levels, 4 or 5 being more complex, 2, 1, and 2s being less complex. A lot of times I'll bill a 4 or a 5, and because I've spent a lot of time and done a lot of different things, with a particular patient, and the insurance company is just saying, nope, we don't think you did that, without requesting records or anything like that. We're only paying you for something less. So it's almost this guilty until proven innocent kind of mentality where the insurer is just arbitrarily saying, nope, we don't think you spent the time that you're saying you did. So we have things that are very patient-centric. We have things that impact both the patient and the provider. And then we have things that are really focused on making the practice of medicine better in terms of getting paid.
We've talked a lot about the role that insurance plays, and we've talked about the role that the physician plays. Does any of this legislation address the role that the pharmacy benefit managers play?
So the pharmacy benefit manager is involved in the drug formulary piece that I mentioned. So while it doesn't deal with the pharmacy benefit manager directly, anything that deals with the medication, the formulary, how the formulary is put in place, a lot of times the insurer and the business may be using a benefits manager. So it touches any part of the process that deals with medication.
From the balcony view, it seems like there are just simply too many cooks in the kitchen.
Well, I think physicians would say would 100% agree with you, Jay. You know, it used to be that, you know, you went to medical school, you spent all those years in medical school and residency and fellowship to be the best clinically trained person that you can be, because that's what patients want. They want to know that the person providing their care has gone through all that. And oh, by the way, spends most of their professional time providing that clinical care, providing that medical care, because that's what you were trained to do. Well, you know what's happened today is anywhere between a quarter and 50% of a doctor's time on a weekly basis is spent on non-clinical stuff, not being in front of me and you, doing the surgery, doing the care, doing the follow-up, doing the analysis. We get burdened with all of these other kinds of things through the insurers, the regulators, everybody else. So we've really minimized what we have trained people to do and spend all that time. And as patients, we really want them doing. So that's why we put forward all of these different initiatives. We believe the pendulum needs to swing back from this overburdened regulatory administrative system with all these cooks in the kitchen, as you said, to saying, doc, what we need you to do is focused on taking care of the patient, and let's have that be your number one, and majority of the time that you spend is with the patient, providing the best care in the most efficient and effective way possible.
Now, our state senators and our state representatives are constantly being barraged by lobbyists from either side. When it comes to these issues, is there any way for the general public to make their wishes known?
There sure is, Jay. You know, if you are struggling with any issue that relates to insurance coverage, we have the Ohio Department of Insurance, and they've actually established a complaint center. And that not only deals with consumer complaints, it shows it deals with complaints from actually people who are involved in the healthcare process as well. So the more patients and the voice they can have is, if they don't believe that their insurer is acting in good faith or following the coverage they should be getting, or just throwing up all these administrative burdens, I would say the simplest place that they can voice their concern, and the Department of Insurance is the one that regulates the insurance company, use the Ohio Department of Insurance Complaint Center. It's online at insurance.ohio.gov. You go there, you can figure out how to complain about your company or the frustration you have with the system. We meet with them on a monthly basis, and that data can be used in providing to our senators and reps about all these issues that we are fighting on behalf of patients.
Well, you've heard it, folks. You've heard it from CEO Todd Baker of the Ohio State Medical Association himself. Lift your voice and make yourself heard if you want to make change. It's just as simple as that. I want to thank Todd for being with us today, and for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
It didn't take long into the new year for the race for governor to really hit the ground running. The leading contenders now have running mates to join them on the campaign trail. Vivek Ramaswamy and Amy Acton named their lieutenant governor choices on the same day, just hours apart. Amy Acton announced David Pepper as her pick for lieutenant governor running mate. Pepper was chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party from 2015 to 2021. He is a lawyer who is also the son of a former Procter & Gamble CEO. Acton said Pepper has a track record as a pragmatic problem solver at the local level, which she said will serve as an asset to her campaign. You'll hear from them in just a minute. Republican gubernatorial candidate Vivek Ramaswamy introduced his choice for running mate at an event in Cleveland the same day.
The goal of actually getting things done. There is no better person in this state to achieve that with me and for me than our Senate President Rob McCauley.
McCauley was elected Ohio Senate President in January of 2025. At the event, McCauley shared why he accepted Ramaswamy's offer.
And as I've come to know Vivek, I know him as a man of faith, and I know his faith drives him as well to be a devoted husband to his wife, Apoorva, to be a devoted father to his two sons, and soon to be a daughter on the way. That same drive drives him to have the purpose and conviction to lead Ohio.
Also on that same day, Governor Mike DeWine endorsed Ramaswamy for governor. In a statement, DeWine said, in part, Ohio is winning new business projects from the coasts, and Vivek will keep the momentum going. Vivek Ramaswamy knows that Ohio is the best state to build a business, raise a family, and pursue your vision of the American dream. 10TV's Kevin Landers takes a deeper look now at who the candidates for lieutenant governor are, and they could not be more opposite when it comes to their political views.
54-year-old David Pepper is the former head of the Ohio Democratic Party who left in 2021. I asked him why he's jumping into politics now.
It's a crisis time. People are struggling, and it's time for good people to get involved and do something about it.
41-year-old Rob McCauley served in the Ohio Senate since 2017 and was elected president of the Ohio Senate in 2025. McCauley is 100% pro-life and supported the heartbeat bill. Pepper is pro-choice and led the charge to enshrine the right to abortion in the state's constitution. McCauley was an outspoken critic of Dr. Amy Acton's role as a director of the Ohio Department of Health during COVID. He supported legislation to end the government shutdown and supported stripping Acton's power by limiting the length of her directives. Acton stepped down from her post under political pressure. I asked her if she has the stomach to lead if facing the same pressures as governor.
I wouldn't be doing this if I'm not tough enough. I refuse to look the other way. We deserve better in Ohio, and I'm going to give this everything, everything, to solve the problems of everyday life.
Pepper was a staunch supporter of Acton while she was the health commissioner, saying her aggressive approach saved lives. He called the Republican response against her policies reckless behavior. Both Pepper and McCauley are law school graduates. Pepper graduated from Yale Law School, McCauley from Toledo College of Law. Pepper is from Cincinnati, McCauley is from Napoleon in northwest Ohio, southwest of Toledo. Pepper says he and Acton are committed to reducing child care costs and reducing the cost of home ownership.
The state's at a point where it needs a clear, dramatic change, and maybe for the first time in a long time, people are connecting the dots that the reason they are feeling so, you know, so little breathing room and so stressed on every part of their life is in part because the state of Ohio isn't serving them.
That was Kevin Landers reporting. Both parties expect to spend millions to win this election. The Ramaswamy campaign announced it has raised nearly $20 million. Acton says she plans to release her fundraising total soon. I talked with a Democratic and a Republican strategist about the running mate selections. Both like their candidates' choices. And Democratic strategist Joe Retoff says David Pepper is a strong selection. He's the former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party, former Cincinnati City Councilman and County Commissioner, who has also run for statewide office. Retoff says he's a good fundraiser who knows a lot of people and understands the whole state.
He has years of experience, hard campaigner. Relationships across the state, has been to all 88 counties multiple times. These are deep relationships with people that he has built over time. I know him personally. His work ethic is tireless.
Republican strategist Terry Casey focused on State Senator Rob McCauley's legislative experience. He is the Senate president and has served in the Senate for 7 years and the House before that. Plus, he gives some geographic diversity to the ticket, as Kevin mentioned, being from Napoleon in northwest Ohio.
And it's important if you're going to be an effective governor to have somebody that knows and can work with the legislature. And he's also somewhat unusual for a person at his level as Senate president, somebody who's, as a politician, almost ego-free because he's more focused on getting the job done.
Both Retoff and Casey say the running mate is important on the campaign trail to get the message out. But ultimately, people vote for the top of the ticket. And there are two other Republican candidates running for governor, Heather Hill and Casey Puch. Hill chose Air Force veteran and reality TV star Stuart Motes as her running mate back in October of last year. The Republican primary is coming up on May 5th. Ohio U.S. Senator John Husted is also up for re-election, running against former Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown. I caught up with Senator Husted to talk about the big issues of the day, including ICE operations in Minnesota and around the country, the fight over health care costs in Congress, and the U.S.'s role in Venezuela after U.S. forces captured President Nicolas Maduro, who now faces drug trafficking and other charges in the U.S. What about the idea of the United States running Venezuela? What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it has to be a collaboration at the moment because you can't, what you don't want to have happen is for it to go back to this lawless regime that was led under Nicolas Maduro. So the United States needs to have this involvement. We're doing it through economic levers right now. There's a quarantine on the oil that's coming out of Venezuela. That's their primary source of revenue. America is going to help sell that oil on the open market and make sure that the money that comes out of it isn't going to fund lawless regimes and drug traffickers. It's going to the Venezuelan people and institutions to restore economic stability. And once that economic stability is restored, then you can have democratic election.
Do you anticipate U.S. troops being on the ground in the country?
I do not anticipate U.S. troops being on the ground. If that were to happen, that we would need to have some type of congressional authorization to have it happen. Right now, it's being done through diplomatic channels, and that's the way it should be accomplished.
As we see what's unfolding in Minneapolis over the last couple of days, do you support continued ICE actions in cities around the country?
So when ICE is a legitimate part of the U.S. enforcement of our laws, when people are in this country illegally committing crimes, the president has made it clear that they need to follow the laws and ICE will enforce those laws. Mayors or governors don't get to decide where ICE operates. And ICE operations have led to the arrest and deportation of criminals who are guilty of drug trafficking, of child pornography, pedophilia, rape, murder. We're getting some of the worst people out of our country, and you're seeing the results of that because murder rates are going down. Communities are safer, but these are not, I know some of the ICE appearances are not welcome in some cities. But look, you got to follow the rule of law in this country. You can't have protecting people who are killers and rapists in this country. If they're here illegally, they need to go. And ICE operations are a legitimate part of federal law enforcement. And it's a tragedy, though, about what happened in Minneapolis yesterday. People should not try to interrupt ICE operations. That is obstructing justice. It is illegal, and unfortunately, tragedies can occur.
People do have the First Amendment right to protest. So, how do you balance?
They do, but they cannot obstruct ICE operations.
I get that, but how do you balance, you know, a federal program like ICE carrying out law enforcement actions while maintaining public calm during protests?
Well, people should stop inciting these protests. It's okay to have your voices heard, but you can't obstruct an ICE operation.
The Affordable Care Act tax credits, of course, are news this week as the chambers come back into session. The House is working on it. What do you anticipate happening? Do you see the ACA credits being extended and then working further on healthcare issues?
So let's just do a reset here. Obamacare has failed. It is very expensive and people have limited a number of choices. We've seen consolidations. And so American healthcare consumers are in a pinch right now. My proposal extends it for 2 years, requires everybody to pay at least $5 a month for their premiums so that we don't have fraud of people getting illegally signed up, capping it at 700% of poverty so we're not subsidizing the premiums of millionaires, and then protecting to make sure that public funds are not being used to pay for abortions, which is a long-standing principle in this country. If we can get, we have bipartisan support for that, but I'm not sure we have enough votes yet.
You just introduced the Upward Mobility Act, and in it you wrote, Americans trapped behind a benefits cliff are disincentivized from pursuing higher paying jobs. Can you explain what your bill would do to change that?
I see people just getting trapped in poverty. If you're a single mom with two kids, you have food assistance, childcare assistance, housing assistance. You may work 20 hours a week making $17 an hour, but if you work 21 hours a week, you lose all of that assistance. Literally, you fall off what we call the benefit cliff. And so what happens is that people don't work. They get trapped in poverty. They can't ever get a raise or a promotion because they lose more in benefits than they gain in new salary. And so I'm trying to end that by creating a pilot program at the state level, creating a uniform funding stream that will allow people to earn more money, to work more hours, and then gradually see their benefits decline as they earn more so that it actually pays them to go to work.
And you can watch my full interview with Senator Husted on 10TV Plus. Just download the app on your TV and watch for free. As I mentioned, former Senator Sherrod Brown is running against Senator Husted in the November election. Brown released a statement on the Trump administration saying the U.S. will run Venezuela. Brown says hundreds of thousands of Ohioans are struggling to make ends meet, yet Washington continues to make their lives harder while prioritizing foreign countries before our own. Ohioans are facing higher costs across the board and are desperate for leadership that will help deliver relief. We should be more focused on improving the lives of Ohioans, not Caracas.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday Morning Public Affairs Program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.